Chicago Theater of the Air presents the world's greatest operettas for the world's greatest radio audience. Story and the immortal melodies of Friedrich von Plotho's Martha. Our speaker is Colonel Robert R. McCormick. Our stars are Marion Clare, Eugene Conley, Ruth Slater, Douglas Beattie, and Earl Wilkie. Our musical director is Henry Weber. Our producer, Kenneth McGregor. Tonight, you of the audience will be asked to people the stage with a colorful company of your own imagination as we recreate a nearly century-old favorite in its captivating setting of Merry England. To our service guests tonight, a special welcome to men of the Army, Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines. And to all servicemen, a cordial invitation to be present on these operetta evenings whenever possible. The uniform of the armed services is always honored as a ticket of admission. Once again, we are very greatly privileged to present the speaker of this and all our operetta evenings, a soldier and historian, a publisher and patriot, for 20 years an authority on the liberties of an American under the provision of the Bill of Rights, the editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune. Ladies and gentlemen, Colonel Robert R. McCormick speaking to you from New York City.
Last week I spoke on the rights of Englishmen, quoting from the original document. Tonight I will begin a discussion of the much more comprehensive rights of Americans and the efforts made by our forefathers to preserve them for us. Those of you who were listening last year may remember that I recounted the settlement of the 13 colonies and that the colonies were, for the most part, refugees from persecution. Because of the provenance given to Massachusetts, historians to the Pilgrims, it is quite commonly believed that most of the settlers were refugees from Jacobite oppression. Such is far from the case. The families of the men to whom we owe most for our Constitution and Bill of Rights fled from the Long Parliament in Cromwell. The forebears of Western Pennsylvania and Virginia from William III. After the head of Varian succession, they were Jacobite refugees from the fury of the Duke of Cumberland. They were refugees from France, from Northern Italy, Switzerland, and Germans from the Palatinate. These last found conditions so superior to their former ones that during the Revolution, they were the most loyal subjects of the British Crown. With the outbreak of the Revolution and the expulsion of the royal governors and judges, the citizens were automatically restored the common law rights of Englishmen. But they were far from satisfied with them. The Declaration of Independence, adopted by the Second Continental Congress, sought its authority in the rights of man, as conceived by the great political philosophers of the 18th century, of whom the greatest was George Mason of Virginia. "We hold these truths to be self-evident," wrote Thomas Jefferson, "that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." He then listed the offenses of the king and Great Britain against the colonies. Most of these evils passed with the revolution, but certain of them were dealt with in subsequent instruments, and some of them are not yet cured. He wrote, I quote, "He had made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries. He had erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out our substance, for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond sea to be tried for pretended offenses." Then came the most momentous statement in history. "We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states." The Congress then advised the states to adopt constitutions. Under Mason's leadership, Virginia was the first state to act and adopted the first Bill of Rights in 1776, all of which Mason wrote, excepting the reference to religious freedom, which was written by Patrick Henry. The first Constitution of Massachusetts, written in 1780, which did not include a Bill of Rights, was overwhelmingly rejected, and the second one was adopted in 1782 after a Bill of Rights of 32 paragraphs written by John Adams, who had been in the company of the great Virginia philosopher for 7 years, had been added. It is interesting to observe that while this Bill of Rights provided for freedom of religious worship, it also provided for a Protestant state church, which, however, was never set up. We may observe in passing that years later, Congress passed a law for a national church, but President Madison vetoed the act as violating the Bill of Rights. One by one, each of the 13 states adopted a Bill of Rights, and every state that was subsequently admitted to the Union has done so. So did the Republic of Texas. So did the Confederacy in 1861. I cannot conceive that Congress will admit another state into the Union that does not have a Bill of Rights as the heart of its constitutional law. If all of the settlers of the colonies had fled the same oppression, they would probably have set up a government limited to their own religious belief. Having escaped from different oppressions, the idea of freedom of worship arose early in the colonies. Religion had been free, notably in Rhode Island, Maryland, and Pennsylvania, and religious oppression had been practiced in other states, principally Massachusetts, New York, and Virginia. Unity against the common enemy compelled toleration of each other's convictions. We find in George Washington's diary that he, a lifelong member of the Church of England, attended services of all the other churches during the Second Continental Congress, and we find that John Adams, a Congregationalist, moved that an Episcopal minister conduct services for the Congress. Catholics were among the signers of the Declaration of Independence and of the Constitutional Convention. The states began the Revolutionary War under the feeble direction of the Continental Congress, and in 1778 formed the Confederation. The idea of the Confederation was not novel. There had been the New England Federation. There had been Penn's Plan of Union in 1697. There had been the Auburn Union, proposed by Franklin in 1754. And Galloway's proposed union of 1774, which missed adoption in the First Continental Congress by only one vote, and which John Adams thought would have prevented the Revolutionary War. The Confederation has been too much criticized. It was an apical step in the direction of nationhood. It named a nation. It passed the famous ordinance for the governing of the Northwest Territory. It prepared the public mind for national government and was an indispensable step in our development, and therefore deserves immortality rather than reprobation by us its beneficiaries. How this bloomed into the great Constitution of the United States, we will see next week.
Colonel Robert R. McCormick, editor and publisher of Chicago Tribune, in an address from New York City. Copies of Colonel McCormick's talk may be had for the asking. For your copy, which will well repay detailed study, write Station WGN, Chicago. Now the principals and chorus, the narrator and the orchestra have taken the places on the great studio stage. The orchestra's tuning up. The musical director's already at the conductor's stand. There's the tap of the baton. And Henry Weber conducts the sprightly Overture to Martha.
Performed this night at the Grand Opera House, recently applauded by Her Majesty Queen Victoria, the mighty Emperor of Austria, and the wealthiest slave owners of all New Orleans, this magnificent story will be unfolded in a performance without peer, this night at the Grand Opera House. Seats are still to be obtained at prices which fit the purses of all. Here he is.
story of Martha is a story of England in the days of good Queen Anne. An England which was as neatly divided socially as a mince pie cut squarely in two. On the one hand were the well-born lords and ladies, who were always ladies and gentlemen regardless of behavior. On the other were the common people, lowly born, who regardless of behavior could never hope to be ladies and gentlemen. So here in the opera Martha, they meet. So here's to be ribboned ladies and bewigged gentlemen, to beauty patches and snuff boxes, and the hearty farm folk who will soon foregather at the Richmond Fair.
I'm a very naughty man, naughty dog, my heart and sleep, naughty dog, my heart and sleep. Better from before the sunny sleep, so far the world is deep, so far the world is deep.
Unhappy. The very flower and perfume of the London court, first lady in waiting to Queen Anne, petted darling of the London nobility. But she was bored, and of course the arrival of her fussy old cousin, Sir Tristram Mickleford, did nothing to improve matters. Cackling and fawning, capering stiffly on his old joint, he still hoped to win her favor and her hand. But Lady Harriet only yawned until suddenly she heard light-hearted song outside. Bad Sir Tristram raised the window so she could refresh herself with the eager gaiety of laughing servant girls off to the fair at Richmond. Lady Harriet was envious of these happy girls. Suddenly, she had an idea. She called her maid Nancy and doting old Sir Tristram and told them they were all three going disguised to the Richmond Fair. Nancy was a little shocked, and Sir Tristram was almost apoplectic at the suggestion. But Lady Harriet insisted and even coaxed him to try a few dance steps, which would help make their forthcoming masquerade the more convincing.
La, 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 la.
Fair. Rustic bodice and peasant garb replaced their usual expensive court dress. Lady Harriet gave each a new name for the day. Sir Tristram was dubbed Old Rob. Her lady's maid was rechristened Julia, and Lady Harriet herself assumed the plainer but equally pretty name of Martha. And Old Rob, Julia, and Martha found merriment abounding when they finally reached the Richmond Fair. Yes, the fair at Richmond was exciting. Stalls piled high with the bright colors of fresh fruit and vegetables. Fortune tellers were busy, and Punch and Judy shows drew crowds of goggle-eyed bumpies. But the principal business of the fair centered on white-skinned, rosy-cheeked English girls, come to be hired out for the coming year by the shrewd farmer folk. For farming is hard work, and both men and girls know it.
To the fair,
performers of the fair, too, caught the merry eyes of the masquerading Martha and Julia. These two stout young lads were the foster brothers, Lionel and Plunkett. Years before, Lionel had been brought to Plunkett's farm by his father, an extremely sick man. The father then died, left but one single clue to his previous life and fortune, a ring. A ring which he said should be shown to the queen herself if ever Lionel were in extreme need. But Lionel's life with his foster mother had been a happy one, as in a reminiscent mood, he even now confided to his foster brother.
Not a lonely friend, let pilgrim seeking at your cottage door, need your friendly roof, a shelter in his arms, his son he bore. This poor pilgrim was my father, who do you? With his dying breath imploring that his child through life you'd guide. That his child through life you'd guide.
Yes, a month of he did linger, ne'er revealed his rank or name. Dying placed upon your finger, yonder ring of dual flame. Should the danger e'er come near you, send it straightway to the queen. Let it heal that all beneath. She will know what it doth mean. She will know what it doth mean.
Here in me can be content, have I passed my life.
Suddenly, all eyes turned toward the sheriff, there to begin the hiring of servant girls. He glared at the crowd and in the queen's name read the official proclamation.
Hats off, rustics. Look at me. 'Tis our royal will and pleasure. We, Queen Anne, hereby decree to all subjects of the crown dwelling here in Richmond Town, whosoever at this fair engages to perform a servant's part, for 1 year her service pledges, let none from this law depart. Once the earnest money has been taken, then that bargain must remain unshaken. Ye have heard. Be it well understood.
And then the sheriff in charge, one by one, the servant girls stepped forward, curtsied, and began to describe their individual merits and accomplishments for the benefit of the farmers, who chose from among the girls according to their domestic needs. And Martha watched with interest, curious too about Plunkett and Lionel, who seemed to find none of the girls to their liking.
Mr.
Martha and Julia found it great fun. But old Sir Tristram grumbled and complained of everything. His country clothes, his nickname of Old Rob, and in fact of the whole disgraceful expedition. But as luck would have it, he wasn't around when the two good-looking young farmers approached the two court ladies in their peasant dress and wanted to hire them as servants. Nancy was almost speechless when her lady continued the masquerade and asked deep-voiced Plunkett what their duties as servants would be if he hired them. Pointing to Nancy, Plunkett replied,
"You're for the farmyard."
The farmyard?
To keep the house and stables clean. You, my lass, shall do the cooking, mind the garden.
You don't mean it? As a gentle, tender creature should clean your stable.
See my garden.
$50 crowns
shall be your wages. All expenses shall be paid. Weekdays, cheese and beer for supper. And on Sundays, good roast beef.
Good resist this splendid offer.
Good resist this splendid offer.
Done.
Yes, done.
And by the powers, here's a handful you are born.
And completely unmindful that they had been legally hired to work for a year, the two girls discussed Lionel and Plunkett's gentle manners, while those two were ecstatic with the grace and beauty of their new servant. When Lady Harriet and her maid Nancy, now Martha and Julia, tried to back out of their bargain, the two brothers would have none of it. And with the sheriff's help, forced the pair to climb in their farm wagon, offer the country and a full year of domestic service. Old Sir Tristram screamed in protest, but as the first act curtain fell, he was left hopelessly and helplessly behind. He was left hopelessly and helplessly behind. Before we continue with the old-fashioned story and the immortal airs of an enduring operatic favorite, we pause briefly for station identification. This is Mutual. Again, we are speaking to you from the Chicago Theater of the Air. As the curtain rises on the second act upon Plato's ever-popular opera, Martha, a strangely assorted quartet has reached the farmhouse of Plunkett and his foster brother, Lionel. It is dusk as the cart turns creakily into the barnyard and the frightened girls realize their escapade has gone much too far. But Lionel and Plunkett are pleased at their timidity and daintiness, and with unusual humility, the two men open the door and invite the girls to enter. Once inside, however, The two men are confounded by the abrupt manners of their pretty new servants. Removing their wraps, they hand them to the girls, who refuse to hang them up. Julia dashes Plunkett's hat to the floor. Lionel, hoping that gentleness will serve better, politely offers his hat to Martha, who only stares at him haughtily. Abashed at this surprising revolution in his domestic staff, Lionel exclaims,
I'm filled with consternation. I know not what to say. Has it been the fashion to say a master?
I'm filled with consternation. I know not what to say. Now, has it been the fashion to say a master?
Unexpected revolution, Lionel and Plunkett decide some work must be done. And since there is much unfinished spinning at hand, they order the girls to sit down at the spinning wheels and begin. And more amazing still, these beautiful girls stare dumbly at the unfamiliar wheels with no slightest notion of how to make them go. Angrily, the men seat themselves at the wheels to give the terrified pair a first lesson in the art of spinning flat.
Why, set the wheel of flying, set it whirring, set it flying.
Julia can stand no more, and pushing both the wheel and the astonished Plunkett on the floor, she runs out of the room with Plunkett in pursuit. Martha attempts to follow them, but Lionel's gentle touch restrains her. He suggests that if she can't work, she can at least sing for him. Then something in his manner awakens her interest, and looking deep in his eyes, Martha responds by taking a red rose from her hair, handing it to her master, and singing an unforgettable serenade to them both.
Martha and Lionel were by then shyly aware of the extreme happiness of the moment. But it was soon shattered by Plunkett's return with a furious Julia. Awkwardly, the foster brothers decide that tempers have been tried enough for one night. They suggest that all four respect the midnight hour and retire.
Midnight hour.
Midnight hour. Good angels walk
and my scorning pull to my
Martha and Julia were shown to their room and locked in, where they sat whispering fruitless plans of escape. The brothers retired, and soon there were only the sounds of night to be heard. The frogs, the cricket, the quiet rustle of the night wind in the trees. That is, until a sharp rapping on the window of the girls' bedroom startled them from their discouraged mood. They saw the gaunt white face of Sir Tristan pressed against the pane, motioning them to silence. Quietly, the girls raised the window and stepped outside into Sir Tristan's carriage. With only one backward glance, the servant girl Martha and her maid returned to Durham Palace and the life of Lady Harriet. Passage of time, and rises again on a rustic tavern by the royal forest, where Queen Anne and the ladies of her court often hunt. But seated now at the inn are a group of farmers from the vicinity, among them Plunkett and Lionel. Plunkett is his usual merry self, and Lionel finds little cheer in the company or in the foaming glasses which inspire his foster brother to toast the grateful brew.
Thanks the world over, canyon is open. Why does this Britain beat his foe by land and water? Why? That is because his drink is beer. That is the best of all good cheer. John Bull can fight and guard his sight in battle. Oh! The best of great Lufian Rumors for all.
Hunting horn sharply interrupted the song and merriment, and knowing the queen and all the fine ladies of the court were coming there to that same inn, the farmers quickly finished their beers and left the scene in haste. And his melancholy brother Lionel had strolled to a nearby grassy knoll, where out of sight of the inn, Lionel threw himself to the ground to dream of his lost Martha, the servant maid who vanished almost at the moment love was born. Worried, Plunkett urged him to unburden his heart, to speak out his love. With a sigh, Lionel sang his heartbroken adoration of the one he thought gone forever. Lionel buried his face in his arms. Plunkett looked up suddenly to see Nancy and Lady Harriet, who had left the chatter and laughter of the other ladies of the court. For Lady Harriet, too, had come to know heartbreak and longing since the night she had stolen away from the farmhouse and returned to Durham Palace. And all but forgetting their own unfinished romance, Plunkett rushed to Nancy, even as Nancy ran to him. And with their heads together, the two loyal friends try to think of some way of ending the pain of these other two, Lionel and the Lady Harriet, both so much in love, yet in rank and station, worlds apart.
What to do?
What to do and undo?
What is to do?
We must now show our allegiance by a true and full obedience to a wayward man and mood. Feel her proud swain is subdued.
Well, what then?
What then?
What then, what then?
What then?
I shall then be very lonely, left quite lonely, sad and lonely, of one damsel thinking only, whom to court I do not dare. No, it's more than I can bear.
Oh, indeed, will you be lonely?
Yes, indeed, I shall be lonely. Yes, indeed, I shall be lonely, thinking of one damsel only, whom to court I do not dare. No, it is more than I can bear.
That is sad.
Is too bad.
I've a thought.
Well, speak it out.
Why, of course, you ought to marry. That will all your cares dispel.
Ah, for that I need not tarry. Farmer's folly like me well. Farmer's folly like me well. Farmer's folly like me well.
Marry her.
Let me alone.
Say to why?
A stupid wench.
In that case, quick, choose another. Made for us, maybe had.
Sheriff and perhaps would have me, but her temper drive me mad.
Sheriff,
yes, her temper drive me mad. No, 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 she will not do.
You must wed.
But where? But where?
I don't know.
Indeed, indeed, indeed.
Love with you gives way to friendship.
Love with me gives way to friendship.
In your stubborn mood you glory.
In my stubborn mood I glory.
Yes, he woos me, yes, he sues me.
Yes, I woo you and I sue you.
If he woos me, he must choose me.
Lassie, I will woo and choose you. And choose you. Yes, I'll ask you for one word, for one word, for one word. I will ask you for one word. I will ask you for one word. I will ask you for one word.
By this time, Lionel had come to be aware of Lady Harriet's presence. When he saw her rich velvet riding habit, sweeping ostrich plumes and glittering jewelry, and heard Nancy call his Martha Milady, he realized his love was hopeless, that Martha was no servant, but a lady born. Then there was pain in his eyes, keener even than it had been during the long days that he sought her. And leaping to his feet, he reviled her with that precious melody she sang to him that first night.
But my life I would destroy. What my pleasure to deceive me, with my breaking heart to toy.
Martha tried her best to explain that she was sorry for her actions that day at Richmond Fair and swore that despite the difference in their stations, she really loved him. But Lionel's hurt was such that he would not listen,
He was about to rush headlong away when a new blast of hunting horns announced that Queen Anne herself had come to find the cause of the disturbance. And as Lionel prostrated himself before Her Majesty, she spied his ring, the ring his dying father had told him to show the Queen in case of extreme need. And the Queen, true to his father's word, bade him rise, questioned him closely, and finally declared within the hearing of all that Lionel was none other than the rightful Earl of Derby, as his father had been before him. Then was Lionel overjoyed and full of the happy knowledge that he did indeed have a right to woo his love, not as Martha, but as the Lady Harriet. He, not Lionel, but the rightful Earl of Derby. And he crushed her in his arms with a cry of joy.
Oh, happy bliss forever mine!
Well, my Nancy, what can you do?
I'm linen.
For deceiving and intriguing.
And to govern you and form you into all that I desire.
Done, you're a dandy one.
Then here's the handsome page.
I've got the sign to follow and there's all the bargain day in our turn.
And with the four now reunited forever in love, Lady Harriet turned softly to the song which first wove its spell around them. And with the greenness of new spring in the air,
also to Colonel Robert R. McCormick, who is our speaker of the evening, our narrator, Brett Morrison, and our producer, Kenneth McGregor. Chicago Theater of the Air will turn to another of the great Victor Herbert melodious operetta scores. Starring Marion Clare and Felix Knight, next week's production will be Victor Herbert's Sweetheart. That's next Saturday for Sweetheart. Plan to be with us next week, the week following, and all the weeks of the glorious operetta season to come. Tonight's performance is the Pam Goodhart Music Library. Marvin Miller speaking. This is Mutual.